Can you elaborate on your criticism of, it's not what you said, it's how you said it? I've heard it in older podcasts, and I wonder if you've changed your mind on this idea. My point is, a lot of face-to-face communication isn't message itself, but rather body language, facial expressions, cadence, rhythm, and the tone of one's voice. Language itself is a recent invention, evolutionarily speaking. You can say good luck, or you look nice sarcastically and or in a mean-spirited way.
Right.
Yeah, and of course, right? Good luck, right? That's right. Good luck, right? Yeah. You look nice, or
you look nice.
Yeah, I get that. So for sure, there's my end scene, there's my acting training kicking in, right? So it's not what you said, it's how you said it. If someone in your life is being sarcastic to you or is giving you that sort of double meaning or whatever, then the problem is that you've let them deal with you in that way. You can't tone police people who are in your life, because the reason that they're maybe being sarcastic to you or negative towards you is because you've let them do that. You've enabled, encouraged, invited them in, let it continue, let it participate. So tone police is nonsense, because if somebody is being that indirect towards you, like that sarcastic, that manipulative or whatever, then just why would you tone police them, right? Why would you tone police them? If they're that sneaky and deceptive and underhanded and manipulative in their communications, why tone police them, right? Tone policing is because somebody's being sarcastic to you, and they're sarcastic to you because of what you've let them do over years. So blaming the other person for their tone when you've allowed that tone to continue for a certain amount of time, I don't really understand it. All right. Could repetition compulsion also include self-re-traumatization, even in isolation from direct harm? In other words, someone who's gotten out of abusive environment, seeks out conflict, violent content, war footage, for example, and abuse online to somehow replicate or remind him of previous abuse. Is safe environment and therapy the only way of dealing with this pathological need? So repetition compulsion, in my obviously amateur view, so repetition compulsion is not something that you just feel the need to re-traumatize yourself. I mean, nobody feels the need to re-traumatize yourself. This idea that there's this self-destructive pathology in the human mind, I resist and revile it. I think it's a horrible, not that you're horrible, I'm just thinking of this idea. It's a horrible, horrible idea. That boy, you know, you've just been so harmed that you just put yourself in these terrible, dangerous situations. You got some serious thrill issues, dude. Or, you know, the people who cut themselves, right? I remember, I don't think I ever published it, but I talked to a woman who her mother called her a slut when she was a kid, a teenager, and she ended up carving the word slut into her thigh with a knife. Now, this is not just she's turned against herself, and you have to look for the external influences. You know, like in America, right, or the West as a whole, people didn't just sort of wake up and say, hey, I think we'll just do a whole bunch of stuff that's really harmful to our civilization. That's not how it works. It's not, people don't just wake up and say, wow, you know, I just had a narrow escape. I think I'll punch myself in the face. That's not how people do. Like if you just manage to survive a parachuting accident, you don't go jump off a building. People don't re-traumatize themselves. You don't see zebras when they've escaped from a lion going up and poking the lions. It's not what we do. This idea that we turn against ourselves, and I don't know. I just think it's highly dangerous nonsense. So no, I don't accept it. So then the question is, of course, why do people do that? Well, they do that because the enemy in the mind is commanding them to do that. It's really not that complicated. I mean, why does somebody do harmful things to themselves when they've escaped that direct harm? Because the person who harmed them wants them to keep harming themselves so that they don't turn on the person who harmed them. Right? I mean, everybody who's had a brother has probably had that thing where your brother grabs your arm and, you know, hits you and says, hey, stop hitting yourself, right? I mean, it's kind of a goofy thing, but there's an element of seriousness in it. If you had a father who beat you, then will you put yourself into dangerous situations? No, you won't, but he wants you to remain in dangerous situations. So you can blame yourself, so you can look into it. It's a way of him programming you to act in a way that prevents you from judging him, evaluating him, right? See, here's the thing. If you've mistreated your child year after year, decade after decade, then you have a problem. And the problem, you have two problems. Number one, if your child decides to not see you, to separate from you as the result of unrelenting, unapologized for abuse, then you have a social problem. And the social problem is, how are you going to explain that? How are you going to explain why? Like, one of the reasons why there's so much trash talk about me on the internet is if people have listened to me and have tried to reform abusive and destructive relationships and have been unable to reform those abusive and destructive relationships, then they may choose to end those abusive and destructive relationships, or to be more precise, they have realized that they aren't relationships in any real way. They're just exploitation. So, you know, the cult nonsense that was around, I don't know, a decade and a half ago or whatever, why was that? Well, if you're an abusive parent and your child stops seeing you, you got to explain it somehow, right? Now, do you say, well, you know, I was a pretty terrible parent, man. And, you know, my kid came to me and tried to talk to me about it. I just shut him down and escalated and continued to abuse him, told him he was wrong, told him he was crazy. So, yeah, I just was really mean to him for decades and then just kind of drove him away. You're not going to say that. Of course not. What are you going to say? He got sucked into some online, you know, you're just not going to take responsibility, because if you could take responsibility, it wouldn't have ended up that way. This is as clear as day to anybody with, you know, one squinty pirate eye to look at, right? So that's your one problem. And the second problem is, when you age, you need resources from your children, right? You're aging out and you need help. You need help to get medicine. You need help to go see the doctor. You need help to be reminded of things. You need physical help. You just need a lot of resources. Now, if you've been mean to your kids, and when they become adults, if they talk to you about it, or they come to some realization, or they get a good therapist, or someone who helps them recognize that they've been abused, and then they he's bugging off, he's scoping, right? If they make a run for it, they make a run for the boundary, then you don't get these resources, right? So you have kind of a ticking thing in your hands, right? Which is, you've really been mean to people, and now you need a lot of resources from them. What are you going to do? Well, you don't want that person to turn around and judge you in any objective moral way, right? This is why objective universal morality has always provoked people enormously. It's not about abstract things. It's not about, you know, laws. It's not about any of that stuff. It's about simple, primal family relations. It's really all it's about. It's where most people do their processing, right? So if you've been an abusive parent and a universal moral comes along that harms your interests, you can become a better person, and some parents do. They become better people. They apologize, make restitution, and so on. Not super common, but it absolutely happens, and it's very encouraging when it does. But most people just double down. They just, well, I yelled at my kid and got my kid to do what I want. So now my kid is displeasing me as an adult. I'll just yell at them more and gaslight them more and attack them more until they do what I want. You know, just keep banging that TV until it does what you want. And that's tricky. So you don't want the person you abused to have an ally. You don't want them to discover universal morality. And you don't want them to hear the simple moral arguments that expose the whole racket. So you've got to have that person keep attacking themselves, because when they're attacking themselves, they're not attacking you, right? I mean, it's a fundamental principle of warfare that if you get your enemy to attack himself, your job is mostly done. You barely have to lift a finger. So you get, when you look at people being self-destructive, there's no point looking at some weird pathology and internal, like, all that's happening is they're attacking themselves so that they don't attack their abuser, and the attacker or the abuser has programmed them to do that so that they don't turn around and see where they came from. So it's repetition compulsion. It's just obeying, for reasons of survival, usually the whims and wishes of the abuser. All right. Why do some people get stuck in the past or have an urge to return to things in their history? For example, movies, video games, music, or places. In my experience, it creates an illusion of safety and reminds me of an asylum which I needed when there was chaos and uncertainty in my life, and I had to somehow manage it. I feel like there's no underlying, I feel like there's an underlying sadness in this. Is this what we know as nostalgia? So nostalgia is a return to a time when hope was more vivid. So when you're young, you look at the future and you have great and grand hopes for your life, for your society, for the world, for virtue, morality, what do you know, improvement. You have great nostalgia for all these things. Now, as life plays out and life goes forward, hope gets whittled down by experience. Right? So what's the second marriage is a triumph of hope over experience? I mean, I'll tell you this. When I was a kid, I had enormous passion, positivity, and hope that I could escape my crazy environment, the environment of my family, and to some degree my school. But I could escape my crazy family environment, and I could get to a sane and wonderful place. Now, personally, in terms of my actual personal relationships, it's beautiful. Mission accomplished, and then some, right? I got to a saner, better, more wonderful place. Very soon, I'm going to have my 20th wedding anniversary, and I love marriage even now, even more now than when I first got married. And when I first got married, I loved it enormously. So that's been great success. I just released a show that I did with my daughter, where she answered some very tough questions. And she's 13. She did a great job. And I mean, you can hear the fun that we have with each other. That's not a put on. That's not an act. It's just how our days generally go. So yeah, when I was younger, I thought that reason would win. I thought facts would win. I thought free speech would win. I thought debate and evidence would win. And that's because I mistook the world for myself. And it's a fundamental error, and I get it. I've sort of pounded into me. Because I find evidence irresistible. I mean, if somebody provides me counter evidence or evidence for something, even if I find it intellectually appalling or unacceptable or shocking or negative or something like that, I would feel such a deep sense of enslavement and shame and dishonor to reject empirical evidence. It would just be appalling to me. It would make it very vivid to me that I was enslaved. And I can't stand that feeling. I find it repulsive. So when evidence flows my way, and the evidence is important and morally necessary to understanding the world and hopefully alleviating some of its ills, I can't reject it. I can't reject it. It's an appalling idea to know that 2 and 2 make 4 and to pretend that the opposite of that is true, or that you could never ever say it. Oh my God, it's appalling, absolutely appalling. And I don't know exactly why that is, but it is. I was a socialist when I was younger, in my early teens, and I read the evidence and it was like, okay, well, this is kind of overwhelming. I believed in all sorts of nonsense when I was younger, spoon bending psychic powers. I remember having a whole dinner with my daughter, with my mother, where I was talking about, you know, all my predictions for what was going to happen in the year 2000 and so on. And as the evidence came in and as my experiments with my powers of telekinesis, you know, this stuff was floating around in the 70s. It was very sort of popular. And so, you know, I would try lifting the record needle from my 10cc Things We Do for Love 45 and moving it back to the beginning. And no matter how much I concentrated, I couldn't do it. I tried reading people's minds. You know, you go through these experiments when these ideas are floating around. And I was fascinated by UFOs, and I would stay up sometimes half the night with binoculars trying to find UFOs and all that kind of stuff, right? So you try and test these things, you try and work with these things, and the evidence began to become overwhelming that this was all nonsense and lies. I mean, I remember very clearly the idea when it came to me about psychic phenomenon. Okay, well, if it was possible in some manner for human beings to read each other's minds, that would have been such an evolutionary advantage in terms of hunting, in terms of war, in terms of whatever, right? That would be such an evolutionary advantage that it would very quickly sweep across the entire planet. Because the people who had the genetics to read each other's minds would do so much better than everyone else that, you know, it's like you can, my eye, blue eyes, right? You can trace blue eyes back to one dude. And it was such an advantageous adaptation, so attractive to women that, bingo, bango, bongo, you ended up with blue eyes all over the place. Although I think the numbers are diminishing now, hopefully in even numbers. So I just genuinely think it's just a matter of pride. You know, to be forced to lie, to be forced to reject reasoned facts and evidence is to be a slave. It's to be a slave. I find that repulsive. Now, of course, I had to lie when I was a kid, because when you grow up with crazy people, then you point out their irrationality. I mean, I remember having an argument one night with my mother about socialized medicine, and then, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, she just came screaming and, you know, like just complete short circuit, right? So it's not the mark of any kind of free, independent, or reasonably proud soul to bow to anti-rationality. And of course, a lot of what's going on in society is just putting forward the most ridiculous propositions and demanding and bullying that people simply nod at them and scrape and bow before them. It's hideous. It's hideous. So I have never been good at rejecting reason and evidence. In fact, again, it's appalling and shameful and a great stain upon the soul of any kind of rational pride to give up on reason and evidence and to speak the opposite of what you know to be true. And of course, I thought, I'm a human being. I can't be that off the far off the bell curve for these things. So I was like, well, until I had facts, reason, and evidence, I was lost, degraded, debased, confused, chaotic like Helen Keller before language, right? Just a blur of conformity and confusion. And you get the reason and evidence, you get the facts, the ability to think for yourself. It's beautiful. It's like sunrise. It is more than sunrise, because sunrise reveals a rational world that was hidden by the dark. This creates a rational world that exists only because of the light. It's incredible. So I was like, well, I was confused and maltreated intellectually and told lies and forced into blind conformity with hideous mysticism, falseness, conspiracy theories, fakery of every kind. And then when the light of reason exploded, it's almost like thermonuclear exploded before me, blew my hair right back. I thought, well, gosh, I mean, I breathe oxygen and I respond to reason. I flourish, thrive, live in the light of reason. I breathe oxygen and thrive with reason. And escape from error like a man clawing his way out of a burning building, through the wall if need be. So, of course, I thought, well, I have two legs, I have two arms, two eyes, I breathe oxygen, I respond to reason. Other people have two arms, two legs, two eyes, and they will respond to reason because we're all human beings. Whoopsie. I shouldn't laugh, but yeah, like serious mega uber whoopsie. Not the case, right? So nostalgia is returning to a time when you had hope more than you have experience. The experience, of course, is that not us, we few, we happy few, but most people, you are trying to cure them of an illness and they genuinely perceive that you are an evil person trying to inject an illness into them. All their relationships hang on lies, their self-esteem hangs on lies, their income hangs on lies and corruption, and any wind of clarity that blows these cobwebs away reveals for themselves a gargoyle where they believe they have a prince in the mirror. I mean, there was an old show called Freaks and Geeks, and I just remember one scene in it where the young man was looking up video games in a department store. And I remember looking at that scene and I paused it and I felt this just this ache, this rush. It's when I was, you know, that age, when I was a little kid and there were video games coming out, the Atari 2600, my first computer, the Atari 800. learning how to program, and just I had such immense hope for the future that I could bring to the world what brilliant people brought to me, that I could echo and amplify and clarify the light of reason that had landed on me like a ton and a half of liberating bricks. And man, did I get that shit done. Man, did I get that shit done. Until it couldn't be done anymore. I got maximum shit done until it couldn't be done anymore. So I understand nostalgia. You think of nostalgia like somebody who's ended up in a terrible marriage, going through a terrible divorce. How does that person feel when he looks back on his wedding photos or his wedding video? All that hope, all that happiness, all that joy, all that anticipation, and it all went to shit, right? It went to collapse, calamity, disgust, distress, courts, you name it, right? Or you see this as well with, you know, people who've just become terrible parents. And they look back on the baby pictures with a great sense of loss. And because back then they had hope they could be good parents, and it turns out they had bad parents. They became bad parents. And people look back at their wedding videos or wedding photos, and they say, God, this is back when I had hope. Back when I had hope that everything was going to work out beautifully. It was going to be a fairy tale, happily ever after. And now I'm living in my car and can't afford a lawyer. So yeah, no, I get nostalgia, man. I really, really do. To be able to rewind and have a different outcome, well, that's part of hope, right? Now, I don't have hope, but we can give hope to the future. I don't have hope for myself, but I have hope for the future. That we are in a descending arc, but we can give the tools to have people correctly identify what went wrong and not repeat it, right? Where would we be in the West without Aristotle, without Plato, without Averroes, right? Without the pre-Socratics, where would we be? We had to reinvent all of that again, right? So there were Dark Ages, and then we got the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, we got science. So I don't have hope for now, but I do have hope that these conversations and what we're recording, and what, of course, millions of people across the world are doing, or at least five, that we can accelerate the recovery from the chasm we're entering. Now, before I thought we could avoid the chasm. Now I know we can't, but all we could do is put a big trampoline at the bottom and help people go back up. All right. Do I have any thoughts regarding geoengineering? I really don't. Sorry. How do I know if or when the only purpose of my life is to serve as a warning to others? I mean, there's kind of like a joke about that stuff, and I understand where that joke comes from. But assuming you're not on your deathbed, there's always time to change and always ways to do things better. All right. Let me see here. Hi, Steph. What are your thoughts on young men learning martial arts? Is it truly better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war? So the saying goes. Martial arts is tricky because, I mean, there is a lot of simulated violence. I know a lot of people who did martial arts who got significant injuries. The brain injuries are always the big worry with that kind of stuff. But I mean, a friend of mine who was a fairly decent at judo, he was fighting some big Russian guy. The Russian guy landed on my friend's knee at the wrong angle, and he couldn't walk for like 6 months. I mean, so it's pretty dicey. I'm more for sports. You can get the same level of exercise. You can get the same thrill of competition. You can get the same, you know, dominance thing that goes on for men. So I'm a big one for sports. Although, you know, here's the trick. You know, this is just a mental trick. I'm going to share this, not particularly philosophical, but very interesting for me. So listen, I have a pretty intellectual life, obviously. But I also like the physical side of things. I really try to not have the mind-body dichotomy, right? So not too long ago, I was playing a racket sport. And have you ever had this where every time you try to place the ball, you miss? Like if you just react and play back, you do fine. But every time you're like, oh, I'm going to send the ball over there, you kind of interfere with your body's natural rhythm and you just mess it up, right? And it was almost like a voice where my body was saying, look, you get to play all the time. You, Mr. Brain up there, top of the brain stem, Mr. Vanity post monkey beta expansion pack guy, you get to play all the time in writing, in podcasting, in role-playing Dungeons and Dragons, in all of that. You get to play all the time. You get to play in your dreams. Just give me an hour where I, as the body, can play and just get out of my way. And it was like, it was a very interesting kind of conversation that I had with myself. And I did. I was like, you know what? I'll get out your way. You play. You hit the ball where you want to go. I'm just going to be along for the ride. In the way that my body is along for the ride when I'm doing like really intellectual stuff. And it's like, yeah, I'll support you. I'll keep the butt pumping and all of that. But this is your gig, your corner, man. The spotlight's on you. And we're, you know, the shadowy orchestra in the background, keeping the rhythm going, you know, like the keyboardist for the Doors, you know, with his left hand, they didn't want to have a bassist. So was it Ray Manzarek or whatever his name was? It was like, do, 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 do. He just did the bass. And this is why one of the reasons why the Doors sounds so wild, because he's doing most of the keyboards with one hand because there's other keyboards doing the bass line. So yeah, it was really interesting. And I was just like, yeah, you know what? I get so much play in the intellect that I'm just going to let the body do its thing and play. And it really was, boy, did my game ever improve. It was really an interesting phenomenon. So yeah, I mean, the martial arts stuff is fine. You're never going to get to use it really in real life. So you don't get to be a warrior with martial arts, really. So is it possible for family to not be dysfunctional? Depends on your definition of dysfunctional. The more functional that you are in your life privately, the less functional you are in society. Because, you know, society's kind of nuts, and if you're sane in your environment, then you're perceived to be crazy or bad or whatever by society as a whole. So I think that in the future, when we have a sane, rational society, then families can be perfectly functional. But right now, you know, every parent who's raising their children according to reason and virtue, the non-aggression principle, you know, we recognize that we are not building children that will fit easily into society. I mean, I think that's kind of the point, because who wants to fit into that madhouse at the moment, right? Can you also talk about the phrase, just let it go, or let go of your anger? It really irks me that people think you can will yourself to not be angry without dealing with the issue. Yeah, so, I mean, whenever people say stuff, right? I mean, myself included, of course, right? Whenever people say stuff, the first thing that I ask is not, is it true? The first thing I ask is, what's their motive? What's their motive? If there was a virus that wanted to invade your body, take you over and kill you, or just reproduce as viruses want to do, the first thing it would say to your immune system is, hey, don't react, man. Don't react. I'm a friend here. I'm just hanging out. I'm just coming in, and I'm just going to, you know, just chill and roam around a little. Don't worry. I'm no big deal, right? And then it would just go and start reproducing like crazy, right? So when I hear people say, oh, you just got to let go of your anger, man. With the move on, just got to move on, right? The people saying move on are still talking about the antebellum South of the 1830s. Just move on, right? It's almost 200 years now. Move on, man. So yeah, and that's the pandemic. Just move on, right? People are completely unable to move on, right? So move on or let go of your anger or don't be angry. The first question you got to ask is, okay, well, how does it serve other people's interests if I'm not angry? How does it serve other people's interests if I'm not angry? Look, I tell you something straight up, man. If you have two handfuls of people who genuinely care about you in your life, you are a god among men. Just about. And I'm not just talking online. I mean, even the people you meet, even maybe people you had a relationship for a long time, just about everyone is playing you. just about everyone is playing you. Now, again, I don't consider that the case in my life. My friends and family are wonderful people, and we look for each other's back. We care for each other enormously. So it's not the human condition. But, you know, certainly prior to wisdom, virtue, philosophy, and knowledge, yeah, just about everyone's playing you. So when somebody says, oh, man, you got to learn how to let things go, man. You got to learn how to let things be in the past. Don't get so angry. You got to chill, man. They're not talking because they have some independent evaluation of what's genuinely good for you as a human being. They're just running game on you for their own self-interest. I mean, they're just running game on you for your own self-interest. That's all they're doing. It's not that they genuinely care about you. So when somebody says, well, you're hanging on to the past, you got to let go, man. That's not them evaluating you and what's best for you. They're just dealing with their own shit and projecting it onto you. So you got to say, okay, well, if my anger is a bad thing, who's it bad for? Say, oh, no, it's bad for you, man. It's bad for you. How do you know? If anger is bad for me, why did I evolve it? Right? Your skin is really bad for you, man. You should use duct tape and gravity magnets to keep your internal organs in, right? That's what cellophane is for, man. Scotch tape. Scotch guard a little if you don't want to shower. So it's okay, well, why do I have anger? If it's bad, oh, because it's just dysfunctional, man. You're just holding on to your anger. Okay. Let's say I'm holding on to my anger. The question is why? Why am I holding on to my anger? Well, you just got to let it go. It's like, so I'm angry at person X, right? Let's say I'm angry at my sister. I don't have a sister. Let's say I'm angry at my sister, right? Some family member comes to me and says, you got to let things go. Let's say she just constantly lies about me and to me, right? She's a liar. Say, man, you got to let go of your anger towards your sister. Okay. Has she stopped lying? But you can't just let your emotions be so dependent on her, man. You got to just let things go and move on. She is who she is. She's doing the best she can. It's not perfect. It's not ideal. I'm with you. But you got to just find some way to move on and accept her for who she is and blah, 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 right? So then this is coward shit 101. Coward shit 101. Straight up. I hate this stuff. And I'll tell you why. Look at me getting angry. I'll tell you why. Because someone who comes up to you and says, man, you've got to stop being angry at your sister for being such a liar, right? You're going to stop judging her, right? So that person is coming up to me and saying, hey, Steph, people can really change. People can really change. You got to let go of your anger, right? It's okay. So then my first question would be, okay, have you talked to my sister and told her to stop lying? Well, no, I mean, come on. I'm just trying to help you, man. It's like, no. If people can change, then my sister can stop lying. If I can change and let go of my anger, then clearly my sister can stop lying. So why are you talking to me, not her? Why are you talking? If you're in a conflict with someone and you have reasonable assumptions that you're in the right and someone comes to you and says, well, man, you got to let go. You got to move on. You got to forgive and forget or that, right? Like let's you got a mean mom who kind of snipes at you and puts you down in public, family gatherings, whatever, right? And you come and say, man, you know, she is who she is. You know, it's not ideal, but she's doing the best she can. And you got to just find a way to forgive and forget and move on and blah, 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 and accept her for who she is. It's like, oh, so people can really change. People can change. Fantastic. Okay. So if you have the assumption that people can really change, like I can just let go of my anger, people can really change, then tell me how your conversation with mom went about not putting me down in public. And of course, they never do any of that shit. It's all just about getting you to change and you to appease the bad people. Well, you as a good, sensitive, moral person, you should completely fucking reconfigure your entire emotional apparatus. Because, you know, that's totally possible. But the person who's lying or putting you down, well, we've just got to accept them for who they are. Okay, well, if you can accept a liar and an insulter for who they are, why don't you accept me being angry for who I am? No, that's different, man. It's like, fuck off. It's just manipulative, cloying, claustrophobic, polyfiller up the ass, atomic wedgie bullshit. Ooh, it just drives me crazy. It's so cowardly. There's a bad person and there's a good person. I'm going to pour all my efforts into defusing the good person rather than confronting the bad person. Why don't you tell mom to move on from putting me down? Why don't you tell my sister to move on from lying about me, right? If you're just supposed to accept people for who they are, then why do they accept that I'm just angry at them for behaving badly? If you're supposed to accept people for who they are, why don't you accept that I'm angry? No, you should change. the bad people, the insulting people, the mean people, the abusive people, the dysfunctional people, well, they're just like gravity. We can't change them. But you as a good, sensitive, moral person, well, I'll get you to change. Which means that being good means that people will pile on to try and change you, whereas being an asshole means that they just step all the way around you, go to your victims, and lecture them. Oh, it's so vile. If you're going to do good, man, first thing you got to do is start with the bad people. Don't start with the good people who are reacting to the bad people. Don't start with the people who are angry at being violated. Start with the people who are doing the violating. Start with those people. And if you don't want to, fuck off. If you don't want to start with the people who are actually doing wrong, who are abusive, mean, whatever, right? If you don't want to start with those people, that's fine. You don't have to. But then don't sort of walk around like the king apeshit agent of change. Well, you know, I'm really going to make sure that these relationships work out. I'm going to sit down and try and get people to compromise this. No, you're just going to pick and nick at the good people and appease the bad people. The bad people can't change, but the good people can be lectured in giving up their anger at the bad people. It's like you're just a courtier of a black and bloody god. You had a king like Macbeth with blood on his hands, and you're just the courtier saying to the peasants, well, sorry, man, you just got to accept that you got a violent, deadly king. You got to change, man. Ugh. I mean, it's one thing to say people can't change. Okay, then people can't change. Okay, then put me in the category of people who can't. No. You can change, though, man. You can change. They can't change. You can. You're better than them. You got to be bigger than. Why do I have to be bigger than people? Why? Go talk to them who are doing me wrong. And the way that you fight back against these people is you just say, okay, who's right and who's wrong? Well, I don't care. It doesn't want to get into that. Okay, well then, don't tell me to change if you don't know who's right and who's wrong. My sister lies all the time. My mother puts me down in public. Do you think that's okay? Do you think lying all the time or putting people down in public is that good behavior? No, it's not ideal. I get that. Okay, then go change them. If people can change and you're coming to me to change, go change them. Stop betraying the good people and treating the bad people like some law of nature. All right. One time you said you would produce a compendium of types of child abuse and the personalities that result. You said you would explain what type of childhood would produce a communist. Yes, the type of childhood that would produce a communist is available. freedomain.locals.com, but it's for subscribers only. My review of the album The Wall, with a little singing as well. You can get that, but you have to sign up. You can use the promo code UPB, all caps UPB, 2022. All right. I'm not that girl, but I have been cutting for decades. Well, I'm sorry about that. I really am. But you're not cutting. You are conforming and complying to people who want you to cut yourself so you don't get mad at them. My brother posted on a hate forum that he lost me to you. They never asked me a single question about my experience despite me trying to talk about it for years. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really, really sad. It's really sad. Steph, is being a toy collector, Lego or Hot Wheels, as an adult signs of being frozen in time as a result of childhood trauma? Are people who collect toys as adults simply people who are unable to grow up? Sorry if this double posts. I didn't think it went through the first time for some reason. Well, it's not good. I understand. So they're not unable to grow up. When Jim Morrison, the psychotic and pretty evil singer-songwriter from the group The Doors, who died, of course, at 27 in 1971, His whole life was acting out his child abuse in the desperate hope that somebody would notice and care. His whole life. So Jim Morrison's father was a military man. His father and mother had said, we're not going to spank our kids. So instead of spanking their kids, they poured torrents and torrents and torrents of verbal abuse on those kids. Torrents of verbal abuse on those kids. Now, no spanking. Torrents of verbal abuse. And Jim Morrison told someone later on in his life, and I believe him, that he'd been sexually abused by somebody very close to the family when he was a child, and repeatedly, and he went to his mother and said, help me, help me, save me from this. And his mother basically said, you're a liar, didn't happen. And, right, so he was betrayed, right? And he became nihilistic and anti-Christian, right? You listen to When the Music's Over, yeah. Right, when the music's over, the name of the song or the first couple of lines, When the Music's Over, Turn Out the Light, that comes from the Whiskey Club where they did a couple of months worth of gigs until he had this Oedipal, want to kill my father and have sex with my mother rant on stage. And when the music's over, turn out the lights, he screams in the middle of the song, save us, Jesus, save us, save us. Now, this is him crying from under the family member who was raping him as a child. Save us, save us. The Soft Parade. When I was back there in seminary school, they put forth the proposition that you can petition the Lord with prayer. Petition the Lord with prayer. Petition the Lord with prayer. You cannot petition the Lord with prayer. This desperation, this shriek, this scream, because he prayed to God to save him from being raped as a child. But God did not answer his prayers. And instead, Satan took him and gave him, in a sense, right, gave him fame and power and glory and beauty and sex and, right? And then he died, killed himself, basically on drugs. He was facing charges of public indecency for supposedly exposing himself to a crowd of like 10,000 people in a concert. He was sometimes dragged off the stage because he was unzipping his pants and so on. Now, later on in his career, and it's amazing how meteoric the rise was, they went from like meeting and starting the band to a number one hit, which was the trimmed down version of Light My Fire in only 2 years, a remarkable rise in speed. And Jim Morrison would say, he would stand in front of the crowd. And he would say, well, I've been reading these books about children and their parents. Why am I like this? Why am I so fucked up? Because I didn't get enough love as a child. Boom, says it straight up. And people are like, well, he's so sexy. It's like, no. This pathological sexiness, so to speak, is the result of having the eggshell of your sexuality mutilated and broken way too early. But since you complete are selected, God knows what the hell happened to Michael Hutchins, but I assume that. Whenever I see that sort of feline cat-like sexuality that is compulsive and sprays like a wild seed across the entire audience, you just know that this person had their sexual boundaries violated extraordinarily early, extraordinarily brutally, and then their sexuality, like an exploded egg, just like cracks and flows everywhere and overwhelms people. So yeah, he was straight up saying, I was abused as a child. He's told people I was raped as a child. He tells the audience I was unloved as a child. But nobody... I mean, you openly say these things and people don't pick up on it. They don't help him. When the music's over, turn out the light. Very simple. God did not save me from my rapist. There is no God. There is no afterlife. When the music's over, turn out the light. There's no afterlife. There's no God. There's no virtue. And he saw the death of the West through child abuse. He said, the West is dead. The West is done. The West is over. And he knew that because he was raped as a child. Repeatedly, brutally, I assume. And he begged for help and was ignored and put down. And he manifested his crazed dysfunction. He was, I think we can guess how he was abused sexually as a child, because he had a compulsion for anal sex. That's basically the only way he liked to have sex was anal sex. And he's got a whole song. I'm a backdoor man. The little girls understand. And he also was, he had underage girls in his hotel room as a rock star, the rock god. He went through his whole life skywriting, I was eaten half alive by childhood predators. This is what it does. Nobody cares. Hey, can we make money from him? Hey, he looks really sexy in those leather pants. He's got nice hair. He's so thin. He's so pretty. People don't, they just skate right over this dead body. They step right over the dead body or the half dead body of the child to grapple the adult phallus of the broken soul. IQ of 149. He was in a society that didn't care about him, obviously stating, he says to his audience, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people, I'm fucked up because I didn't get any love. I didn't get enough love as a child. Nobody cared. Who intervened? Who helped? Who wrote sympathetically? And so because his society allowed him to be destroyed for the selfish hedonism of his abuser, whoever it was, he promoted selfish hedonism to the society as revenge. Most art is revenge, you understand. Most philosophy is revenge and cover-up. So people can grow up, but the reason they don't grow up is that they keep circling the drain thinking they can somehow avoid judging their parents by waiting and waiting and waiting, as if their parents are going to circle back and give them what they needed and relieve them of the need to grieve. Well, mental dysfunction, as the saying goes, is almost always the avoidance of legitimate suffering. Your parents, they can't love you later, you understand? Your school, your teachers, they can't educate you later. Your mother, your father, they can't mother and father you later. You get it when you need it, or you never get it at all. You understand? When it comes to love, you get it when you need it, or you just don't get it at all. Now, that doesn't mean you never get love. But it's like breast milk. Like, you get breast milk when you need it as a baby. Drinking it later is just weird and creepy. You can't get it later. There's no later for love. And yet we wait back there forever and ever. Amen. Just waiting for our parents to give us what we need. Even when we're 50 and they're dead, a lot of people are just waiting in their childhood rooms, waiting, waiting, waiting for someone to come and give them what they need. It's never coming. It's never coming. It's never coming. It's never coming. And you, no eternal reward will forgive us now for wasting the dawn. You waiting there playing with Lego Millennium Falcon, he's not going to summon back the ghosts of people long gone, long dead, long vanished, long absent, long moved. Not coming back to resurrect the death of you when you were young. They're not coming back to breathe life into you, to give you CPR. They're not coming back to make it all better, to kiss your boo-boos and to hug and cuddle and call you great. They're not coming back. Because that place, that time, is dead and gone in time and space. My childhood is not only 50 years ago. My childhood is billions of miles away. Yeah, I could go and visit where I grew up in England. But it's where I was then is billions of miles away. The planet has gone around the sun. The sun has gone around the Milky Way. The Milky Way has its own drifting. It's gone. And you think people think of going back in time, they just end up floating in space. If I went back, if I stay in the same spot and I go back 50 years, the planet wasn't here 50 years ago. The planet was billions of miles away. It's unimaginably, unfathomably distant. It is beyond our comprehension how distant and unrecoverable our childhoods are. You must grieve. You must grieve. Do doing the same things over and over, waiting for the knock on the door for someone to come and apologize and say, I was wrong. I'm sorry. You were right. How can I make it better? It's not coming. And if somebody did it now, you understand it wouldn't end your suffering from the past. It would actually make it worse because they could have done it at any time. They just didn't do it. I can't say strongly enough, you must grieve. What you didn't get, you'll never get. What you didn't get, you'll never, ever get. If you didn't get childhood love, you will never, ever get childhood love. Why? Because you're not a child. And it's years and years and billions of miles dead and gone. There is no way in hell or heaven to visit your childhood because it's gone physically. Temporally, it's gone. You didn't get enough food as a kid. You can't go back and eat. If you're short, because you didn't get enough food. You can't go back and eat and become taller. You can't get it. When you grieve that, you can move on. As long as you avoid the grieving, you're waiting in that dead, imagined dream room that is the opposite of existence. You have banished yourself to another dimension called non-existence, non-history, non-reality, non-truth, non-here, not here. You banish yourself all the way back there. And you're not waiting because you think something is coming. You're waiting because other people, the people who harmed you, those people want you to wait. Those people want you to sit and wait. Because then when you're sitting and waiting for something good to come, you're not getting mad at them because there's something good you want to come ain't never coming. It's never coming. It's never, ever, ever coming. Never coming. And once you accept that, you get mad. And you stop playing with Lego. I recently watched The Shining. Is this movie supposed to mean anything? Or is it just confusing and impossible for no reason? Is this movie supposed to mean anything, or is it just confusing and impossible for no reason? Well, I mean, The Shining is the story of Stephen King's rampant, horrifying addictions. I mean, he was addicted to just about everything under the sun, bleeding, just twitching. And when his kids were young, I think, too. So, I mean, it was just absolutely appalling. Most artists portray their unlived lives, right? Most artists portray their unlived lives. Art is a way of giving yourself the emotional release without the physical risk or legal consequences. So if you have someone who's constantly writing about murder, they have, in my view, an unlived life as a murderer. I mean, I write about a rational universe. I wrote a novel about a rational universe. I've just started today the prequel to the future, called The Present, of course. But I write about a rational universe, a rational world, a rational society, because that's my unlived life, is living in a rational universe. So, what is Jack Torrance? Was it the name of the guy in the book? What happens? So he goes to the middle of nowhere, isolates himself with his family, and is supposed to be working on a book, and he drinks too much and goes insane. And when his wife finds his book, he just has typed in various different ways all over the page, thousands of pages. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. And then he goes to kill his family, right? Now, Stephen King has been writing, for the most part, the same book over and over again for decades. So the fact that he would repeat the same thing over and over in his story, All Work and No Play Makes Jack a Dull Boy, and the fact that he just wrote the same thing over and over again. Do people feel stronger and better and healthier and more moral when they've read a Stephen King novel? And I read some when I was younger. I took a stack of them and other books when I worked up north, and I would read them at night. No, it's creepy and terrifying, right? It's creepy and terrifying. And there's that scene of child orgy in It, I think it is. Just beyond appalling. So the character in a Stephen King novel generally ends up trying to kill his own family, and I would argue that Stephen King as a writer has half-murdered human hope, contentedness, and happiness, and rationality, because his stories are relentlessly anti-rational, and live life. All the things that the people do in the author's book, especially the protagonist, are what he wants to do but lacks the courage to live. You write it because you can't live it or it's impossible. So with all of the superstition, supernatural, murder, Stephen King could have used his considerable literary talents to add to the rationality, hope, and virtue of mankind, but nope. It's just trash, after anti-rational, after horror, after fear, after dysfunction, after madness, after he's an assault on human reason. The murder of the rational potential of mankind. So I think that's what the book is about. All right. Do you plan on doing Jesus in the History of Philosophers? I've done a show with Dr. Duke Pester, about Jesus, which you should look up at fdrpodcast.com. Let's see here. Have you watched Barry Lyndon? It's an amazing movie. Can you talk about the philosophy of Barry Lyndon? I don't know anything about it. Do you think the purpose of the jab is population reduction? I don't know. Obviously, there's no way to know. I would say this, that it's a little bit of a problem of people's bad childhoods. So when you have a bad childhood and you lack a bond, right? A bad childhood is when you don't have a secure bond and attachment with your parent, which means that your parent loves you and will do anything to help protect you, keep you safe, and make you strong and all these things, which doesn't mean obviously indulging or anything like that. But so if you don't have a bond, you tend to be anxious, you tend to be afraid, you tend to be nervous. And, you know, one of the reasons that the left promotes, you know, promiscuity and opposes the nuclear family is because single women vote Democrat like plus 38 points or something like that. That's nuts. Well, it's actually kind of sane in an amoral way. So when you grow up fearful, then that fear is very easy to exploit. Fear is the strongest emotion, as we can understand, right? Fear is what keeps us alive. So fear is the strongest emotion. So if you grow up anxious, then if a potential disaster occurs, we have to look at the, you know, this is a bit of a market thing, although I understand it's, you know, the family's been under attack by the state and children's rationality and security has been under attack by the state and through education or miseducation and so on. So, but right now the market forces are that if there's a potential disaster, and I think everybody recognized that COVID was a potential disaster, you know, especially when we think of where it probably came from. So how does the media play it? Well, the media wants you to keep watching. How does the media want you to keep watching? Well, it says that there's a disaster. It says, it gives you terrifying numbers. It gives you videos of people falling down, and you keep watching and you keep watching and you keep watching. And that's how the media is going to make its money under the current market system. That's how the media is going to, that's their a profit incentive. Their profit incentive is fear-mongering. And, I mean, the fact that it drives people mentally ill, it literally drives people mentally ill. Like 42% of, was it, millennials are like have been diagnosed with a mental illness. It drives people mad to continually keep them afraid of climate change, of war, of Republicans, of, you know, whatever, right? Extremists. They're just constantly keeping people afraid. It does burn them out and it does destroy them, but the economic pressure and incentive to keep people afraid, to keep them tuned in, to keep them watching your ads or gluing your channel, glued to your channel, is enormous. Now, because the economic incentive of the media is to pump fear into the population, then the population desperately seeks relief from that fear. And of course, one of the ways that we saw people taking refuge from that fear was, you know, voting for incumbents, right? Some sort of stability, you don't change horses midstream and so on. So the economic incentive for the media is to make people afraid. And then when people get absolutely terrified and it becomes chronic, then they're literally crying out. Their soul is crying out from relief, from fear. And then, you know, the flight of angels brings in the vaccine. And then people are like, oh, thank God, this is my relief from fear. So maybe this, I mean, it could be some big agenda. I don't know. Wouldn't exactly be skywritten. But I do know for sure that the incentive is to frighten people. And that creates a massive demand for something that relieves their fear. And I think that's one of the things that played. All right. Steph, do you agree with the statement, there are wrong actions but no wrong feelings? Yeah, I think so. This is why it's universally preferable behavior, not universally preferable thoughts or feelings. Fiery but mostly peaceful, Steph, right? That's very good. What do you think is happening with Bitcoin? Less than 16K. Well, I think there have obviously been some issues with liquidity of certain things, and people are afraid, and you know, people are still the Titanic is listing, but it ain't going down, so there is going to be probably not the bottom yet, but I don't think it'll stay down, my particular opinion. All right. I live in Iowa. We had no vaccine mandate, so I'm insulated somewhat to what others experience in the blue states. Yeah, I mean, so the country, I think, that's been tracking these things that has had the very lowest excess mortality, COVID and post-COVID, is Sweden, which did not lock down and did not close schools and so on. How good looking is Jim Morrison? So Jim Morrison was a chubby kid and not considered good looking. And he had this very famous photo shoot where he was just skinny as a rail. Like, you could see his ribs skinny. And this was a big thing in the Woodstock. Some of the Woodstock guys you see are just complete, like, skin and bone. And the reason he lost all of this weight was he was homeless. Basically, he was living on a roof. For most of his adult life, he never had any home that he lived in that was any kind of permanent. It was hotels and motels and so on. He was living on a roof. He had no money for food. And he was living on apples and avocados from the trees around. He lost like 35 pounds in 6 weeks, not particularly healthy. I think about 5'10" or whatever, and he was down to like 120, 130 pounds, which is, you know, really, really skinny. And the photographer who took the photos of him was like, hey, I can tell you how to stay this skinny and sexy. You just got to throw up the food that you eat. And of course, when he was on a steady diet of drugs, like a lot of people who take a lot of drugs, and this is even true for alcoholics, but a lot of people who take a lot of drugs end up super thin because they just don't eat, right? They don't really eat. I mean, they have that sort of real, the Iggy Pop super skinniness, right? So when he was slender, a very good looking guy, in my opinion, but you know, he had a tendency to pudge up, and he certainly did later on in life. So now, how good looking is Jim Morrison? You might look up the pictures. You don't have to ask me. All right. Look at some pictures from California from yesterday. Beautiful women of all ages grinning at passing abortion measure. Yeah, for sure. It is. It's horrible. You know, it is. It's horrible because, but also enlightening, right? So we've had a lot of trash talk about men, right? Male chauvinist pigs and patriarchy, and men are uncaring and brutal and blah, blah, blah. So we've really, you know, lifted the lid on the dark side of male nature, which is, I guess, fine. But, you know, people are really beginning to see, and I think it's becoming fairly evident now, that they're really beginning to see the dark side of female nature, the manipulative side of female nature. And now I did this short video today, and you know, please check out a Telegram. I post some of the stuff, although, of course, if you're here on Locals, I'll post it here as well, and you probably saw it today. It's a very short video saying, look, yes, women vote left when they're unmarried, and women can, a lot of women are pro-abortion because they want to be able to offer sex to a man. If a woman offers sex to a man, she goes up 3 to 4 points on the 1 to 10 scale, right? So a man who's a 10 will have sex with a woman who's a 6, but only if she offers him sex. If she wants to be his girlfriend, his fiance, his wife, he ain't going for a 6. So a woman who's a 6 can throw the V-net and catch a 10. You can't keep him, but you can catch him. And if you take away women's ability, or you reduce women's ability to offer sex, then they have to settle, right? I just started writing about this. I got two sisters at the beginning of my new novel, and I was writing about how they both have different views of the word settle. So the rather vainglorious sister is like, well, I'm not going to settle. I'm not going to lower my standards. Hypergamy, blah, blah, blah. Settle. Now, her sister, who's more earthy and married to a good guy, and she's had one baby, she's got another on the way. And for her, settle is like settle down, settling a house into its foundations, a tree putting down roots. It's what gives you stability. It's what gives you certainty. So there's two uses of the word settle I really found quite fascinating when it comes to exploring the sort of minds of the modern women, which is what a lot of this book is about. So if you take away a woman's ability to offer sex to a man, what happens? Well, of course, we know what happens. Society tends to advance, because that's how society advanced throughout most of Western history, was monogamy and pair bonding and so on, right? So if you take away a woman's ability to offer a man sex, what does she have to offer him? Well, she has to offer him hard work that can be unpleasant sometimes. She has to help him do his taxes. She has to be supportive. She has to be a good cook. She has to make a lot of money, or whatever she's going to bring that's of value. Well, that's hard work. Jumping into bed is great fun. And if there was a law that was passed that said you have to do hard work for what used to be super fun, well, you'd probably be kind of upset too if it was an amoral situation. So, hey, Steph, thanks so much for all your work. Your work has helped me more than everything I've found so far. I'm really grateful that you exist. I love the truth you speak. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. That's very kind, and thank you so much for everyone for making these conversations possible. Right. Oh, the scene where he uses the axe on the door. Kubrick didn't tell the female lead when that would happen. Yeah, I saw a little bit of the outtakes from that, and Kubrick was pretty brutal on the actress for sure. All right. Don't forget to donate to Free Domain. Yes, if you could, I would hugely appreciate that. freedomain.com/donate. I would appreciate that. You can also tip me here as well. I think Frank Herbert had a troublesome youth, probably neglected by parents too busy hosting cocktail parties or putting extra time in at work. The fantasy and science fiction genre is full of the most appalling abuse in terms of the authors and their histories and so on. Just appalling. What philosopher is most like you in your thinking? None. That's why you're here. Any idea why I care so much about designer clothes? Why does it matter so much? Because, well, it's one of two reasons. One is that you want to pull people in and show your quality of presentation so that they can get to your qualities of personality, right? It's one of the reasons I don't have like a big set and lighting and this. I just want the words. I just want the words and you and I. That's what I want. So if you want to draw people in so they can get the quality of who you are, I can understand a little bit of the designer clothes. On the other hand, though, it can be that you want them to find value in you primarily because of your presentation in order to make up for something maybe you feel you're lacking internally. Did you see that Canada just added Punjabi as an official language? Yeah, I am. I have no particular surprise or shock. Did anyone see the guy that offered the escort $120 to wash his truck and the escort refused? Yeah, that's not that's a lot of work. Yes. Marion Zimmerman Bradley and Arthur C. Clarke. Yes. And Asimov. Yes, indeed. His son was an unbelievable creep. So it is. It's absolutely appalling stuff. So, of course, there's a lot of heroes in science fiction and fantasy. And remember I said the unlived life? So if you have an unlived life as a hero, in other words, if you're a villain, then you're going to write a lot about heroes. So let's see here. How long do you think until the economy collapses? No, I've no idea. Nobody knows for sure. And there's a lot of people in the world who have information that you and I will never have until it's kind of too late. So let's see here. Are we out of questions? Have I come to the end? I have one. Actually, I have a whole mess of them. Also, listen, if you want to do a call-in, if this is something that would help you can email me, callin@freedomain.com, C-A-L-L-I-N, callin@freedomain.com, and I would be happy to add you to the list of reprehensible celebration of blinding illumination. Mark Zuckerberg fires 11,000 employees after spending $15 billion on the metaverse. Yeah, I mean, that was just an unbelievably terrible idea. Just an unbelievably terrible idea. All right. Let me just get here. Last questions. Otherwise, go to the other ones. Oh, people are typing. Thank you, Steph. Great show. Yeah, you know what? Let's do a slightly shorter one. I don't actually have to bleed out the entire time, no matter what. So, yes, thanks everyone for a great conversation, the deep and abiding and humble center of this philosophical conversation. I thank you. I always hope that I'm trying to do the best by using the resources that you support me with to produce the best and most engaging and most enjoyable and most enlightening shows that I possibly can. If you're listening to this, freedomain.locals.com, a great community. You can sign up. You can get either 12 months for the price of 10, or you can just use the promo code, all caps, UPB2022, and you can get a free month. Check it out. See what you like. Get my free book at the History of Philosopher series, which is really some of my best work ever until my next series. So lots of love. Thanks, everyone, so much. Take care. I'll talk to you soon.